Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and Ned Sublett continue the Latin Roll miniseries based on Ned's classic book, Cuba and Its Music, From the First Drums to the Mambo. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. Or should I say Latin Roll? I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and I'm joined by Ned Sublett to continue our discussion of his book, Cuba and Its Music, The First Drums to the Mambo. Ned, welcome back.
Thanks. Hello, people in Podland.
And before we start talking about 19th century Cuba, tell us a little bit about your trip to 21st century New York that you're guiding and conducting.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I run a company called Post Mambo Studies, and we do musical immersion travel. Most of what we've done has been to Cuba, and we've done a number of Cuba trips. We went to Colombia last August, and I just got back from taking 40 people to New Orleans. And in June, we're going to do a five-day musical immersion intensive in New York City, post-Mambo Gotham, the New York most New Yorkers don't know, visiting Afro-diasporic music communities all around the boroughs of New York City.
Well, that'll be fun. And so, make sure everybody has the information. Is there any other contact information we can give people so they can get in touch with you if they'd like to join?
We do it all by email. No website, no social media, none of that. info@postmambo.com. P as in Peter, O, S as in Sam, TMAMBO.com.
Postmambo.com. All right. Email it, make the trip, or snooze and lose. So, Ned, thanks for making that available to our listeners. Now, let's get into 19th century Cuba. So we ended last time talking about the Brits, the brief British rule over Cuba, or I don't know if it was even a formal rule, but the period where they pretty much went in and changed everything and unleashed massive demographic changes that would continue throughout the 19th century. Can you just refresh everybody, what's the big deal that's going on in Cuba in the 19th century?
Okay, well, really, we're talking about the 19th or the 18th, because the
the late 18th, and then the changes
the British takeover of Havana, which lasted about 10 months, was part of the what was worldwide called the Seven Years' War. It was in the war that in the U.S. is often referred to as the French and Indian War, referring to the domestic part of it. But this was a world war that some people consider it the first world war that ended with a lot of territory switching. That's when Louisiana went into Spanish hands instead of French hands. But during this time, for 10 months, the British took over Havana. And what they did was they brought in a whole free market kind of free importation ideology for the planters and merchants of the city. So they did a lot better under the British than they had under the Spanish. And when the British withdrew and Spain took back over, this new mentality was well entrenched. And the Bourbons in Spain were also loosening up their trade policies as a result. So after 1762, you start to see an increased flow of Africans, captive Africans, to Cuba. This is really the beginning of the sugar industry in Cuba, big time. In fact, Hugh Thomas, who wrote this numbingly thorough book about Cuba, a history of Cuba called Cuba, The Pursuit of Freedom, doesn't even bother with Cuba before 1762. Of course, he's British, so I guess he thought that Cuba began when the British took it over. But as if previous to 1762 in Cuba didn't exist. But if you're talking about the Cuba's participation in the world market as a player in sugar, certainly it does begin then. And then this kicks up to a whole other level after the Haitian Revolution overnight takes out Saint-Domingue as a producer of sugar. And in fact, there are people from Cuba in the Spanish military who go over to Saint-Domingue and steal the French sugar processing equipment and bring it back to Cuba. Ada Ferrer, who won the Pulitzer Prize last year, has a wonderful book called Freedom's Mirror that talks about the paradox of how the end of slavery in Saint-Domingue / Haiti was the beginning of the giant growth of slavery in Cuba. And this lasted well into the 19th century. Of course, the African Cuba would be the last place to end the African slave trade. And that was only in the 1860s with the changes occasioned by the U.S. Civil War.
And so these two or really three trends that you've been discussing have some musical outcomes as well. There's something called the contradance or the contradanza that becomes even more famous as the habanera. Tell us about this. That it's a mix up of the French contradance, the Spanish fandango, English country dancing. What's the contradance? Why is it a big deal in 19th century Cuba?
The contradance is a fascinating topic. I wish I had enough time in my life that I could just stop for two or three years and research the contradance in its global manifestations. The contradance was the major dance of the 19th century. It's danced from and was beginning in the 18th and well into the 19th, danced from, you know, New Orleans to Russia. And it's with us still in myriad forms, which I would argue even you could stretch to say might include reggaeton. The contradance, it was a dance of two lines, two files, a cousin to American square dancing, in fact. And with time, the contradance took on various other, there were derivations of the contradance. The contradance became the contrabanza, as it was called in the Spanish-speaking territories, became the danza, which was apparently a couple's dance rather than a line dance. And then that in turn, toward the end of the 19th century, would morph into the danzón, which was the leading form of Cuban music at the beginning of the 20th century, and which is still with us today, especially in Mexico, where there's still a huge culture of danzón in and salons that where people go to dance danzón, more in Mexico than in Cuba. But you will still hear danzones in the work of Cuban jazz musicians today. There was no specific rhythm that was the contradanza. The contradanza could be in triple time, could be in duple time, but what it did have, what came to characterize this whole style in Cuba, where the professional musician class was almost entirely free people of color, was a rhythm. Yes, the rhythm that became branded in the 19th century as Habanera, boom, 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 which is the Antillean beat. It's been bouncing around for centuries now, and it's still the Antillean beat. When I mentioned the reggaeton earlier, boom, 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 boom. It's not that, it's not reggaeton. That is the old Habanera. You could make a mashup of Carmen's Habanera from Bizet's Carmen, which has that rhythm with, you know, there are Bad Bunny tracks you could mash up with Carmen and it would probably work. This rhythm's just been in Jamaica, Cuba, you name it. It's there and it's still there today. So that rhythm, which is also really versatile because you can, depending on how you orchestrate it, it can be boom, 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 or it can be boom, 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 depending on which drums you assign to it. And you can hear already just from those cells I vocalized, thousands of pop hits into the present day that have them. This comes into our music at this time.
Let's go ahead and hear Bizet's Carmen. This is a Habanera Paso a Dos, a dance for two, performed by the Orchestra della Suisse Romande, directed by Thomas Schippers. And that was a Habanera, a dance for two by George Bizet from the opera Carmen, directed by Thomas Schippers, performed by the Orchestra della Suisse Romande. And yeah, the Habanera, the contra dance. And there's also a character that comes up in your chapters on Cuba in this period that I guess inspired the chapter title, Buying Whites and Selling Blacks. Tell us about this Pancho Marti character.
Pancho Marti. Yeah, he was... He was a fishmonger and a slave trader who was very close to General Tacon, and he became the financial power of the time. And he by virtue of his the buying whites and selling blacks was a obvious phrase from the time that referred to his practice of corrupting officials and importing captive Africans. He outfitted the finest opera company in the hemisphere, an Italian opera company in Havana. There were a lot of reasons why you would want to have an opera company that would come to Havana for a long period of time, because the transatlantic trip was long and difficult, and if you were importing stellar talent as he did, it had to be a long contract to make sense. Unfortunately, in the summer you couldn't do anything because it was too damn hot, and those were the peak months for yellow fever. So Pancho Marti wound up taking his expensive troupe, by all accounts the finest opera company of the few that were that there were in the hemisphere, better than the one in New York, on tour in the United States, where they caused a sensation in New York City. This tour was repeated, and the fame of the Havana Opera Company was international. There were at that time three opera companies in the hemisphere: Havana, New Orleans, and New York. New Orleans, of course, had opera in French instead of Italian opera.
And tell us about the role of opera in popular culture in the 19th century. I think people in the 21st century see opera as something sort of hopelessly highfalutin and sophisticated and, you know, above our pay grade. But in the 19th century, this was really kind of the music of the people.
Yeah, I first got a sense of that when I was a student in 1969. I was 18, and I managed to spend the summer in Italy on a North Carolina School of the Arts program, God bless them, which didn't cost very much money. I mean, this kind of thing was within the reach of a student of modest means in those days. And as part of it, we went to the Verona Arena and saw a production of Puccini's Turandot. And the entire arena is singing along the operas. I mean, the arias. And I'm talking about, you know, the cab drivers, the housekeepers in the hotel. Everyone knew the arias. It was popular culture. It was more like going to a baseball game than like going to an opera as we know it. So if you think of that as the model for how things were in the 19th century, pretty much everywhere opera was done, you'd be about right. Also, operas were often composed very quickly, often in response to current events, and were staged as spectacles, lots of spectacle. Famously, you know, the elephants in Verdi's Aida. They would perform an act and then have a tightrope walker or jugglers, or it was a whole evening's worth of social intrigue and diversion, as well as what was going on stage.
And in this same particular period of time, there's something called the conspiracy of the ladders, la conspiración de la escalera, that made it very hard to outfit a dance group, a dance orchestra in Cuba, because so many of the musicians of color were imprisoned over this conspiracy, and that kind of created an opening for the Italian opera through this vacuum. Tell us about this conspiracy of the ladders, and how did Pancho Marti capitalize on it too?
The Escalera conspiracy, actually, I'm looking it up in the book right now so I can say it correctly. Here we go. Page 139. Slave uprisings had become more and more frequent. When a new conspiracy was detected in 1844 in Matanzas, the governmental reaction was violent. In the repression that followed, hundreds were killed and at least 1,000 more thrown into prison or expelled from the island. The episode became known as La Conspiración de la Escalera, the ladder conspiracy, because the authorities tied to a ladder the hands and feet of those they flogged, an old favored torture in Saint-Domingue. It was accompanied by new laws that restricted the movements of free people of color. The colored bourgeoisie was devastated by the repression. The black and mulatto middle class were targeted for torture in prison, where many of them stayed for years. The poet Plácido was executed after 4 months in prison. This is a famous moment in Cuban literary history, maybe roughly analogous to García Lorca being murdered by Franco's forces some 80 years later. And the circumstances of his death by firing squad reported internationally. Havana orchestra leader and contrabanza composer Tomás Vuelta y Flores was tortured and subsequently died. The career of the violinist and contrabassist Claudio Brindis de Salas was cut short by prison, etc. So there was this conspiracy, of course, this prosecution of a repression of the conspiracy, I should say, did not only target enslaved people, of course, but prominently targeted free people of color and the black bourgeoisie of the day. So that this put a tremendous dent in Cuban music, which was largely played by free people of color.
Yeah, there's no way to escape the macro realities of this time. Let's go ahead and hear our next song. This is called The Anonymous. This is a Cuban contradanza published in 1813, one of the oldest known. This was arranged for string quartet, guitar, and harpsichord by Juan José Prat Ferrer. And that was The Anonymous, a Cuban contra danza published in 1813, one of the oldest known. Originally written for piano, this is arranged for string quartet, guitar, and harpsichord by Juan Jose Prat Ferrer. And so we've got this period of time where there's some opportunities for Cuban musicians, but obviously if things go a little wrong, things can go really wrong. And that had devastating impact on the cultural producers on the island. But something else is going on around this time, and that's the cocuyé, which comes into Havana, but it's been rolling along for decades in the eastern part in Santiago de Cuba and introduces the cinquillo rhythm. Tell us about this development and how it migrated from Haiti all the way to Havana.
Yeah, the cocuyé was a popular song. Cocuyé is a coconut. It might not be quite accurate to say it introduced the cinquillo rhythm because the cinquillo rhythm was there, but it certainly popularized it. Bum, ba, bum, ba, bum, bum, ba, bum, ba, bum, bum, ba, bum, ba, bum. And it did make its way from the east of Cuba, which was the stronghold of people with roots in San Domingue / Haiti, to some decades later to the west of Haiti, west of Cuba, where it became, for a while, a very popular song, and where this rhythm seems to have taken hold and rooted in the music culture of all of Cuba.
And how does the clave work into this, into these rhythm patterns and song forms?
Well, my feeling about clave, my thinking about how clave becomes so important in Cuban music is by degrees. That is, it is something that was, you can detect its imprint in the earliest published music, but over the years, over the decades and even centuries, as the African component of Cuban music becomes more explicit and comes more to the fore, the sense of clave becomes stronger and stronger, really coming fully out in the 1940s with Arsenio Rodriguez. Clave is a two-bar undulation. You know, it's usually expressed as bop, 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 bop. But it's not a beat. It's a template. It's a rhythmic key. So that if the clave is bop, 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 that's equivalent to saying rum pam pop kakang kakang kap pam pam bat pam bat pam. If you hear that, you know that's the same as saying pop 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 pop. It has to do with where the accents and the spaces are. Okay, and this is a two-bar pattern, and what the clave does is tell you which way that undulation points. So if somebody's going bop, 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 you cannot go bop, 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 bop against it. That's just, well, you could, but you'd have to resolve it. You'd have to make sense out of it ultimately, because it doesn't fit like that. It fits like bum, bum, bop, bop, bum, bop, bop, bum, bop, bop, bop. Rather than ba ba bum ba 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 bum. If you play it backwards, right, you'll get thrown out the window. Everything will stop. The dancers will look daggers at you, and you'll be fired from your job immediately. So it's really important to know which way the clave is pointing. Now, I say it's a two-bar phrase. There are also one-bar rhythms which are transparent with respect to the clave. Some of the instruments in the orchestra play just one bar patterns. So the cinquillo, pop, 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 is a one bar pattern, right? So you can fit it on either side of the clave. So if you got bum, 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 within that you can fit rum, bum, 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 bum. And it makes sense on either side. Usually, if you see a salsa band, what the conguero, the basic thing the conguero plays, bom, pak, kuk, tom, kik, or whatever he's playing, is transparent with respect to the clave, so that he's keeping the time going, but not necessarily showing you where the clave is. Whereas other instruments may be, all of which is to say that the clave is a way of taking all of this polyrhythmic information and making it fit together like a glove, as Bobby Bird, James Brown's music director, said of funk, with of polyrhythms and funk.
Yeah, it makes sense. And your analogy to the harmonic key, you know, like the key of C or whatever, I think is a really good one. That you know, musicians, Western musicians who've learned harmony know that if you're in a certain key, you can play certain notes. And there's other notes that if you're going to play, you're going to have to play third notes to bring them back into that harmony. And the clave is the overall organizing principle for the polyrhythm. So even though you're playing polyrhythms, there are some rhythms you can't play. Yeah. So
if you're in the key of C, you don't suddenly start playing a measure in F sharp, unless you're, of course, wanting to play a dissonance against the C. But if you stay in the tones that are most common to C most of the time, or you build away from them and back to them, but you hear everything in relation to C. Similarly with a clave, you can play rhythmic dissonances, but you hear everything in relationship to where the clave is.
Yeah, and so if you play something that's out of beat, you gotta resolve it and bring it back into the beat. And let's take a quick break from our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to talk about the most famous 19th century American musician, and I bet you can't guess who he is.
My favorite.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
All right. So, Ned, tell us about the most popular 19th century American musician. And why is it that we talked about him in our New Orleans discussion, and now we're talking about him in the Cuba discussion? What's the connection? Who was he? And how did he get around so much?
Louis Moreau Gottschalk, my favorite. Gottschalk was the first great American concert pianist, the first great American concert attraction in the age of P.T. Barnum. Previously, the concert attraction, the great concert stars had been European. And also arguably the great 19th century U.S. composer. One problem with playing Gottschalk's work today is, well, of course, as with everything else before recording, we don't know exactly how it sounded. We have lots and lots of notes because he wrote and published quite a bit, but that even those notes don't tell us what he did live, because he was a pianist of spectacular abilities by all accounts, and he undoubtedly embellished this music in all sorts of ways. He was apparently very charismatic. I'll tell you a story. I've been trying to get Chucho Valdez to play Gottschalk for years because I feel like he's one person whose technical ability and whose sense of spontaneity and improvisation are enough to give it that sense of freedom and play that it needs. A lot of the recordings of Gottschalk are by classical musicians who tend to play it rather dutifully, you know, but I wanted somebody who had this sense of fun. And I got Chucho the scores, and after about a year, he said, mandame los papeles, you know, send me the papers, you know. So I sent him a volume of Gottschalk's piano scores. About a year later, I saw him. I said, what's happening with that? He said, that stuff is hard. Think of all this. Right. That stuff is hard. Not that he couldn't play it, but it would be, it's a lot of work to play Gottschalk. And then to play it freely, you got to really want to do it. And there isn't really a major interpreter of Gottschalk in our time. Probably my favorite recordings that I've heard are those by Leonard Panario. Tom McDermott turned me on to them. But there isn't really anybody right now who's going around making a career out of playing Gottschalk. And I keep thinking someone will arise. Gottschalk was, of course, descended from Saint-Domingue. And he was born in New Orleans, and by the age of 18, he was already in Europe. He studied with Hector Berlioz, the composer the French composer who specialized in mass sonorities with enormously large orchestras. Gottschalk began doing this too, the famous monster concerts, where there might be 600 participants making a sound that you simply cannot record. You have to be there to hear it. And Gottschalk famously went to Cuba, where he befriended Manuel Thaumel, Nicolas Espadero, and the young Jose White, who would become the most distinguished Cuban violinist and composer of his day, and had his memoirs, Notes of a Pianist, is well worth reading.
And let's go ahead and hear some Gottschalk. This is Bambula by Louis Moreau Gottschalk. Was Bambula by Louis Moreau Gottschalk. And you said this is the track where he moves the habanera beat to the bass.
No. That would be Ojos Criollos, Danse Cubaine, published in 1860. Bambula, which was composed when he was 18, seems to be a kind of a clue as to what you might hear at Congo Square in a very roundabout way, a very stylized way. Donald Harrison recently said to me, that's not New Orleans music. And no, it's not New Orleans music. It's a concert take on something that did go on in New Orleans, though. It's a it's got the bum ba bum 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 ba bum 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 ba bum bum. There's the habanera rhythm, right? Bum ba bum 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 ba bum bum. The musical theme is a folk song from Saint-Domingue, and in the opening parts, the bump bump, you hear the implication of drums. Who knows what we actually heard at Congo Square, but he's telling us something. And Bambula, of course, was the one of famously one of the African descended dances that was danced at Congo Square. Now, this was before he went to Cuba, though. And after he went to Cuba, he heard what was going on there, where they had taken that habanera, and again, those free people of color who's made up the dance orchestras were putting that rhythm in the bass. So in Ojos Criollos, you have a bass line that goes boom, 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 boom. And that has a modern sound to it. In fact, if you listen to Ojos Criollos, published in 1860 in New Orleans, where Gottschalk no longer lived, it sounds very much like ragtime, right? But ragtime doesn't really appear for another 35 years. The Civil War intervenes. I'd like to speculate that, you know, had the Civil War not happened, which, of course, is an impossible thing to think. We don't do contrafactuals. But had there not been this interruption to everything, perhaps the ragtime boom would have happened a lot sooner, because it seems like the musical elements were already there in 1860. Certainly in Gottschalk, we seem to hear them. And 35 years later, when the ragtime boom happens, it traces back to things that were going on in Cuba in the 1850s with this, and especially with this boom, 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 boom rhythm.
That's fascinating stuff. I want to tell us a little bit more about these monster orchestra performances and what Berlioz was doing in Paris and how Gottschalk built on that. And how he incorporated African drums in his symphonies, I believe, for the first time ever?
Well, certainly in concert music, you know, they did not put black people playing drums up in front of a concert orchestra. That simply was not done for many people who were fans of the symphonic music of the day. The drumming of black people was not even music, right? And this prejudice goes on, well, it goes on into the present day, but, you know, we see in the 20th century when recording happens, they record music with stringed instruments, but the rumba, the all-percussive rumba, is not recorded until the 1940s, and that was in New York, because it simply was not considered music. So for Gottschalk, but Gottschalk could hear it. And Gottschalk knew this was music, and he put black drummers in front of the biggest symphony orchestra anyone had ever seen. It was in an enormous feat of casting, an enormous feat of orchestration. And I'm actually looking at Vernon Loggins, just to give you a sense of how big some of these concerts were. This is a different concert, but this is Vernon Loggins' description. This is April 17th, 1861, at a monster concert in Havana in the Teatro Tacon, largest theater in the Americas, one of the largest theaters in the world, built with Pancho Marti's money. The program opened with the performance of a one-act comedy. The first musician heard was Gottschalk's star pupil, Señorita Carrere, who performed before the curtain, as did Gottschalk, who followed her with 3 or 4 minutes of improvisation. Sorry.
He was still thrilling the audience with his roulades and trills when the curtain rose, revealing 39 pianos, a performer standing before each. With Gottschalk playing and also conducting, the ensemble gave his Ojos Criollos and another Cuban dance, which he had recently completed. Gottschalk was called before the curtain so many times that the orchestra of vocal soloists and chords, 500 altogether, had replaced the pianos when he made his last bow and the stage was again revealed. Closing the first half of the program, Gottschalk conducted La Nuit des Tropiques, his monster concert orchestra piece, and the Hymn in March from Charles IX. In the second half of the program, there were only two numbers, Méhul's descriptive symphony La Chasse Royale, with trumpeters playing echoes in all parts of the theater. The second was a military fantasy compiled by Gottschalk and conducted by the bandmaster to His Excellency the Captain General of the Colony of Cuba. So you can see the scale these concerts took place on, how long they were, how massive were the sonorities. And you can also pretty easily imagine the size of the public that they attracted, because, of course, everyone was somehow involved in this production.
And this is definitely a 19th century phenomenon. This is something that they've really never recreated since then. They've never recorded Berlioz, and Gottschalk's monster orchestras have definitely not been recreated since then.
No, now you do see Berlioz's music is a staple in symphony programming, but it's always a big undertaking, and the orchestras they use are usually smaller than the ones Berlioz would have. Berlioz's memoirs are also pretty interesting, by the way, when he talks about, you know, going into a town in Italy where they're going to perform that night and trying to find eight ophioclides.
Eight what?
Ophioclides. What was called it? I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It's not a word we say out loud very often these days. Ophicleide. This is the instrument that in Spanish was called a figle, and it was sort of a baritone horn.
And sorry, apologies for the pauses. My dog is barking, and my mute button is hey. Recalcitrant. And so,
it's the dog's job to bark.
That's right. He's keeping us safe. So Gottschalk's born and raised in New Orleans, trained in Paris, reaches his apogee maybe as a performer in Cuba, later dies performing in Brazil, famously. I guess he had finished the piece called Mort when he died. But did his work get digested by the European cognoscenti, or because he was in Cuba and South America for most of the 1860s, did his work not ever really get its due and get understood by the, you know, the leading thinkers in Europe?
Well, his music was certainly known in Europe from his student days on. Bambula was dedicated to Queen Isabel II, Berlioz and the big men in France were certainly aware of him, and he was a top concert attraction in the United States. So he was extremely famous in his own day. I mean, this is the great age of piano soloists. This is a very interesting moment in music, and I have yet to see a real treatment of this. I like to live long enough to have enough time to just explore all of these issues. I call them the piano nationalists, you know, in every country, with the mass production of pianos and the dissemination of sheet music, as music engraving becomes able to, as the art of printing becomes able to handle music engraving, and we start to see mass distributed scores in people's piano benches. I myself learned to play music taking sheet music out of a piano bench in Lubbock, Texas, not so much from records. That was how people learned music in the 19th century. Gottschalk's music was very widely distributed in sheet music. So people all across the United States, the amateurs would sit at home playing these fiendishly difficult, but nonetheless intriguing pieces. And there's just no doubt that the influence of Gottschalk shows up in, for example, I mentioned earlier, Ragtime. I mean, Scott Joplin had to know Gottschalk. It's unthinkable that he wouldn't have. It's unthinkable that Scott Joplin wouldn't have known that sheet music, because it was very widely distributed at a time when the piano had become a mass medium for the diffusion of music. In the intervening years, though, it seems that we have kind of forgotten our great national composer of the 19th century.
I would say that's a fair assessment. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't even know the guy existed. So, you know, thanks for
and
keeping
the... Oh, great. The music is great.
Yeah.
We recently, you know, I mentioned I took a group to New Orleans. We went out to Acadiana for a day, and we heard from Louis Michaud and Michaud's Melody Makers, a basically a Cajun-based, I don't know if I call them an experimental music group, but a Cajun-based group that played a version of Gottschalk's Souvenir de Puerto Rico, which Louis Michaud, I was never so flattered. Louis said he'd learned about Gottschalk from reading Cubans' music and investigated, found the score, and Souvenir de Puerto Rico, it's P-O-R-T-O in Gottschalk's title, turned out just great in their instrumentation.
That's really cool. And let's go ahead and hear a little more Gottschalk, since I misintroduced La Bambula as the one with the habanero and the bass line. Let's hear it actually. This is the Ojos Criollos from
That's the one.
And that was Ojos Criollos. Sorry.
Can you imagine that played by 39 pianos at once?
I know. I mean, it would make Phil Spector look like an absolute piker. I would love to hear a recreation of that. And like you said, it wouldn't be possible to record it. You would have
to. I used to work with Glenn Branca, who was a composer who worked with massed electric guitar sonorities. And I feel like one of the things I managed to do was get him to go hear Berlioz.
Oh, wow. Talk about worlds colliding, the mentor of sonic youth checking out Berlioz. Tell us about some of these pianists that Gottschalk met and interacted with and influenced in Cuba, like Manuel Samuel.
Manuel Samuel was the great composer of danzas in his day In Salmel was, I think, one of the first composers that we can really call Cuban, who had an unquestionably Cuban taste to his music, flavor to his music. Already the music could be distributed in Cuba. Already we're starting to have music engraving. We start to have... hang on just a second. I'm actually using my own book to prompt me because I feel like here we go. And I did write this sucker 20 years ago after all, so you'll pardon me if my recall isn't perfect. Here we go. The son of a Catalan immigrant and a man of modest financial means was an innovator who creolized the contradanza and composed piano works in various genres that were becoming important to Cuban identity. I think that says it pretty well. Less virtuous pianist than Gottschalk, Samuel was a classic exemplar of the Cuban confluence of the cultivated and vernacular. He played both Beethoven and popular dances and sometimes signed his work with the pen name El Timbalero. And Samuel seems to have been, he was good friends with Gottschalk, and he seems to have been the one who tutored him in how they do it in Cuba. And his Salmel's music is wonderful. If you ever get a chance to hear his contradanzas, and Cuban pianists do play them to this day. Another of the composers Gottschalk befriended, Nicolas Espadero, was privately wealthy and was kind of, I don't know if you'd say he was a misanthrope as much, or simply someone who agoraphobic, but he preferred to stay home with as many cats than to be out in public. And of course, he met and tutored the young Jose White, who composed one of the most famous Cuban tunes of the 19th century, La Bella Cubana, and who welcomed Gottschalk to Rio de Janeiro when Gottschalk made his very last trip anywhere to the place where he would die after conducting his Ode to Death.
What a way to go. I guess it happens to everybody at some point. So,
it happened to Gottschalk when he was 40. I think that was a little, I think we really should have had a little more of Gottschalk. Imagine if he'd lived another 40 years. And of course, there's one other very, very important composer, perhaps the best known composer of the 19th century in Cuba, who was not really. He met Gottschalk at the age of when he was six, Ignacio Cervantes. He was the younger generation than Gottschalk. But when he was six in 1854, they brought in this piano prodigy to play for Gottschalk. And Cervantes composed his first danza at the age of 10. I think I misspoke earlier. I think I said that Salmel was known for his danzas. It was, of course, contradanzas. Cervantes is the one, Ignacio Cervantes, not to be confused with the guy who wrote Don Quixote, was the famous composer of the danza in Cuba. And he may have studied with Gottschalk. We don't really know, briefly. And he went to Paris to study with Gottschalk's colleague, Antoine François Marmontel. So Cervantes spent 5 years as a student in Paris, became friends with Saint-Saëns, with Rossini, with Liszt, and came back to Cuba in 1870. And his one daughter, Maria, his wife had 11 children, only one of them a girl. And of the four of the children who survived into adulthood, the girl was one of them, and she was the one who became a well-known singer and concert pianist, Maria Cervantes.
Good to have some spawn that carried the torch for you. And so, in sum, you've got a list of bullet points on page 155 of the book, and we've covered most of them. There's only two points that we haven't really gone over in these last two episodes that I wanted to bring up. And one was the well-established tradition of military wind bands playing regularly all across the length and breadth of Cuba. And the second is a thriving tradition of comic musical theater that had something in common with its American counterpart, the minstrel show. So tell us about the military bands and the minstrel show and Cuban music, and how, you know, those two things become massive influences on 20th century American music, with jazz being the era of the military bands and Broadway being the era of the minstrel show. How do those traditions play out in Cuban music, and are they going to be a big part of the mambo explosion and stuff that we see by mid-century?
Yeah, we don't think of military bands as important sources of music today, really. We think of military bands as something very constrained, shall we say, but military bands were a major diffuser both of music and of instruments. It's really hard to imagine the acoustic music of the 20th century, I mean pre-electronic, I'm talking about the instrumentarium of jazz, which is basically the residue of the military band, right? And much of the traditional pedagogy comes out of what was developed in military bands. You didn't have an army without musicians. Musicians marched into battle. So with the end of the Civil War, of course, in the U.S., a lot of instruments that had outlived their owners wound up on sale in the pawn shops, especially in New Orleans, where many of the bands disbanded. And so there were a lot of military band instruments available as the beginnings of jazz get going. In Cuba and in Puerto Rico, it should be said, the two late colonial possessions of Spain, Spain occupied these two islands militarily, but the army didn't really have much to do. They sent a lot of military bands to keep the population entertained. So there were military bands all over Cuba, all over Puerto Rico. The musicians moonlighted playing dances as well. So there's a really, really strong tradition of wind playing, of brass and woodwinds in these two islands, which also turns out to affect jazz when in the 20th century, James Reese Europe famously goes to Puerto Rico to find players for his Hellfighters ensemble that will go with the U.S. Army to France in World War One, including Rafael Hernandez. This tradition is still with us today. You can hear it in. Whether in jazz, you can hear it in all the different musics that use brass instruments in Cuba and Puerto Rico. And of course, military bands traveled around the world, the instruments being well nigh indestructible, especially the brass ones. So it's a very interesting study to compare what's been done with the military band instrumentarium all across the world. But in particular, in Cuba, there was a very, very strong tradition of this. That's one. Okay, the minstrel show, which is sort of the beginning of showbiz in the U.S. with all the problematics of the racism that it entails, this dovetails with a very, very old tradition in Cuba and in Spanish theater before that. We can trace blackface back to certainly in the 16th century in Spain. And of course, there's in England, there was Ben Jonson's The Mask of Blackness, at which the ladies of the court appeared in a kind of blackface. This is a very old practice. And minstrel groups did travel from the United States to Cuba. Absolutely, they did. But where they coincided and collided with an old tradition from the Spanish comic theater of representing different ethnic groups and certainly of caricatures of Black people. So this continues into the 20th century. Famously, and I should mention that there's a reason that minstrel groups were popular over and above the problematic of the racism, as I already mentioned, which was that the music had to have been interesting. The music, we don't have recordings of these troops really, but compared with the other music of the day, there was something even to this caricatured version of Black music that was exciting to people, just as, you know, white kids playing Black music in the era of rock and roll was still exciting to the people who bought those records. So there was something that made this music popular, right? And of course, famously, infamously, or however you want to think of it, Black performers also played in blackface or played in minstrel groups without necessarily even being in blackface. W.C. Handy, at the beginning of the 20th century, came to Cuba with Mahara's Minstrels as the band leader and heard a music there that seems to have turned up later as he becomes the first person to introduce the habanero rhythm into a jazz hit, you know, first Memphis blues and then more strongly in St. Louis blues. St. Louis woman, Handy called the rhythm Tangana, but as he put it, when he tried it out at the Black Amusement Park in Memphis, the call of the blood was his phrase. And he thought that there was something in that rhythm that African-American dancers instinctively responded to. I mean, that was the thinking of the day. He saw it as the call of the blood was actually the phrase he used. And he seems to have encountered this in Cuba.
Well, we're bringing it all together, Ned.
They continued to have blackface comedians in white Cuban Miami up really until the present day almost. And they even had in Havana, they even had blackface comedy on the radio, which might seem strange, but
famous dance
radio programs had a studio audience.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the biggest traditions of 20th century American, North American radio was Amos and Andy, descendant of the minstrel show. But my guest has been Ned Sublett. The book is Cuba and Its Music, from the First Drums to the Mambo. We've been talking about 19th century Cuba this time. And when he comes back, Ned, we're going to talk about Afro-Cuba and the various African influences that go to form the Cuban music of the 20th century. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Nate.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate welcomes Peter Jacks to discuss his biography of Peter Asher, the man who went from British invasion artist to the most powerful producer-manager of the SoCal singer-songwriter era. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.